Committee on Business and Labor, and the first thing we're going to do is we have a legislative concept that we are going to make into a bill, and Teresa, you want to tell us about that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, committee members. LC 2302 is relating to the optional retirement plan, which is for higher education faculty under the OUS. The concept creates new provisions and amends the statute that establishes the plan.
Thank you. Once again, members, this does not obligate you to vote yes or no or support or not support this bill. We're just making a bill. Do I have a motion to make legislative concept 2302 into a bill?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Edwards.
I move that we introduce as a committee bill legislative concept. Was it 2302?
Yes, sir. Representative Edwards moves LC 2302 to be made into a committee bill. Is there any question or concerns or discussion? Is there any opposition to it? All right, seeing none, so moved. Now, we have an informational meeting today on unemployment insurance. I understand Mr. Byerly isn't sick, so whoever wants to fill those in wonderful, intelligent, brilliant, capable shoes, come on up. And you guys have done this before, so there you go.
Chairman Schaffler, member of the committee. My name is Mark Hetherington. I'm a policy analyst with the Employment Department. Tom Byerly is sick, wasn't able to attend today, so I'll be trying to do his presentation for him. In the handouts you have, the first one is Oregon Employment Department Fast Facts. Looks like this. I'm going to start on the back side where it says continued next to the title. And what that shows is the calendar year numbers for previous years and then for 2008. And you can see those increase from 2006, 2007, 2008. The numbers where it says pending, I was able to obtain those numbers last night. Number of individuals who received one or more benefit payments last year is approximately 240,000. I don't have the exact number, but I don't see that many 1099s mailed out this week. Total funds paid to all claimants was $954 million, $931,369. So that's quite an increase over 2007.
Mr. Chair, can you
represent
that number?
Would you please repeat it?
That's not on here, correct?
Is it in the report, what you just said, the stat, the amount?
It says continue.
I can barely hear you, sorry.
Ask your question.
Mr. Chair, yeah. So you're giving us the numbers that we should fill in under the pending column, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Can you repeat those two numbers for us?
The first number for the number of individuals is 240,000. That's a round number. I don't have the exact number of those. The total funds paid was $954,931,369.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Did everybody get that?
No.
Yeah. All right, sir.
Couldn't figure out where it goes.
Why don't you start all over?
Okay. Jumping
and everybody pay close attention to what this gentleman's
here.
Saying.
Yeah.
Tell us where we are on your report.
Yeah.
Show it to us.
On the report,
there you go.
It's Oregon Employment Department, Fast Facts, continued. And on the top line, we have the number of individuals who receive payments for each year. And the number for 2008 should be 240,000. Total funds, $954,931,369.
Thank you for your patience.
Apologize for not having these.
Don't worry about it.
In here. Below that, you can see the insured unemployment rate. In 2008, it was 2.93. Week two of 2008 and week two of 2009, 5.26. The weekly benefit amount for unemployment insurance, the minimum right now is $113 per week. The maximum is $482. Below we have the current extensions that are in effect. A regular unemployment claim is good for 26
Representative
weeks.
Representative Cameron.
Mr. Chair, Can you explain to us what the IUR is?
Okay, well, check. I believe it's the number, the unemployment rate for those who are actually insured by unemployment insurance. There's also an unemployment rate that covers all employees, but there you have a certain segment of the population that's not covered by unemployment insurance. So this would actually be the insured population that's unemployed.
Oh. Well, I'll go ahead. Chair's left the room. So when we read about unemployment rates being 9% in the state, how does that compare, that 9% compare with this 5.26? Is that what you're saying, is the 9% are not covered, the total 9%, some of those are not covered by unemployment insurance?
That's correct.
So,
question. Who's got the gavel? Mr. Chair?
Right here. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Representative
Mr. Chair,
Kevin, then Representative Witt. I'll also entertain motions to permanently depose the chair at this time.
Yeah, you do. He just
motion overruled.
That's the last time you chair, but
I'm happy to do that, Brett. Thank you.
And then maybe we can come back and talk about this after they go through a whole report, because I just really want to understand the number that we hear about of the unemployed people, because if you have a real estate agent who is not paying an unemployment insurance, how do we know when they're now unemployed?
If you turn it over on the back side, monthly data, these are the showing the civilian labor force, the number employed, the number unemployed. Then you have an unemployment rate of 8.8, which is not seasonally adjusted, and then the total unemployment rate, which is seasonally adjusted. My understanding is that these numbers come from surveys as opposed to actual. My understanding is that the insured unemployment rate comes from actual unemployment statistics, whereas the others is done more by surveys.
Representative Witt, did you have a question?
I had a clarification. The unemployment rate, whether it is seasonally adjusted or not, is is actually lower than the total unemployment rate, which does not include a whole number of folks, those who have dropped out of the workforce, those who, for whatever reason, don't qualify for unemployment insurance. So that number is actually significantly larger than the 9% that we currently hear about. And my question, I guess, if I may, Mr.
Please,
Chairman, my question would be, what would be quote-unquote, the real unemployment rate when we factor in everyone else? I suspect it's probably closer to 15%.
Okay, that's not a number I have. I'm sorry. I may be able to get it for you.
But that's always the case. There's always that group of folks that, for whatever reason, are no longer qualified or never did but are unemployed. Representative Cameron,
well, that's a good question. I would like to find the number.
I respect the question of Representative Witt, and I guess then I'm not getting my question answered, because I was going down. I asked about the IUR, and what I got from the answer was that is the unemployment rate of people who are insured, who are paying into the unemployment rate.
Right.
Or
that's
employers
right.
are paying into the rate.
Right. So an employer's been paying in for 100 employees, and 5 out of 100 employees who've been paying into the system through the employer are now unemployed based on the claims.
That's correct.
So then there's a 9% rate that is tallied by a survey, mm-hmm. which would include the realtor who no longer is a realtor.
That's correct.
So how do you find out that there's 100 realtors that went out of business this month in the state of Oregon? And include that, because I was always under the impression that 9% was always about the claims that were being filed in our country or in our state.
and that's how you were tracking unemployment. And that unemployment truly, like Representative Witt said, is higher than that 9%. Can somebody answer that question?
Good question.
We'll be right with you, Representative. And thank you for that clarification, Representative Kanemer.
What?
I was thanking Representative Kanemer for his clarification that it's the employer that pays in. Please, go ahead.
Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rebecca Nance, and I'm the legislative coordinator for the department. Actually, the unemployment rate statistics are not tallied by the Unemployment Insurance Division. That is a function of the Research Division. Many of you are familiar with the Research Administrator, Graham Slater, and the insured unemployment rate...
Excuse me. The Research Division of what department?
The Employment Department. Thank you, Representative Kanemer. And, Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, that's an excellent question, and that's been argued and talked about through the ages in terms of how you actually capture the total picture of those who are not employees but maybe self-employed who are no longer employed. The reason that we use the insured unemployment rate and it is done through statistical surveys is that is the consistent way that information is gathered through the U.S. Department of Labor. They take that down to the state level. All states use the same survey information, and that then feeds up to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So that is a huge question, and I'm certainly not an expert on that. Graham Slater, the research administrator for the Employment Department, could certainly explain that better. If you'd like, I could get some information and get back with you on that question.
I think that would be great, because clearly there's a lot of concern and curiosity about this subject.
For purposes of today, the presentation that Mr. Byerly would have given, and these brave gentlemen, my colleagues up here talking with you, are talking about the insured unemployment rate for the conversation of today. But I will
Great.
Get back with you on how come the IUR is done the way that it is and why it's so difficult to capture the other data.
Great. I appreciate
Thank
the
you.
Clarification. Yeah. Representative Witt?
The way unemployment insurance is calculated presently and has been for a very long time is, as Representative Cameron and I believe Representative Holvey and I understand it to be, and the 9% is the unemployment insurance rate that has typically been calculated. The broader measure, which is oftentimes referred to as the real unemployment rate, brings in other people into the system. So the unemployment rate that we typically talk about is not lower. It's not the 5.26%. It is the 9%, and it's frankly larger than that. And Representative Cameron, I believe you're absolutely correct.
And we've had this for four sessions in a row now, and that's exactly the same story we've been told, and I believe. Representative Holvey.
Representative Witt just covered my issues. It's my understanding that the 9% is actually the unemployment rate that is based on the amount of claims that are being the people that are collecting unemployment insurance,
and
the people that are unemployed that aren't collecting uninsurance would make that figure higher.
Here's what my request: Mr. Graham Slater comes in, brings this sheet with that we have today with the amendments, and explains all the questions that we're hearing right now. And can we continue in this without that information and have an intelligent conversation, or should we put this off till we get that information? I'll leave that up to you guys. Do you feel this can be informative without that explanation or not? Because it's going to lead to a bunch of more questions, mm-hmm. then we should just put it off and wait and move on, unless you feel we can get some information on what you have to do. I'll leave it up to you.
Mr. Chair.
I want to hear his answer first. I have no problem moving forward. So, you guys feel comfortable?
There are some other charts. My understanding was that some of the information you wanted to receive was with an update on what Tom Barley gave you back in August.
Yes, that's what we're going to do. First, right. We're going to see what Representative Kanemer has to say.
Well, I guess that I'm not sure what that meeting was about, but I guess part of this is about the solvency of the fund. And,
yeah.
And if we're looking at hard times, we need to know where we really are, and I think that's the point of the briefing. And so I would, but it is helpful to have a clarification that this represents maybe as little as half of the unemployed people in Oregon who have unemployment benefits yet to be drawn, potentially.
And if all these numbers are skewed by the two numbers you gave us, then I think maybe we should just go back, do your homework, come back with all the numbers that represent the nearest amounts you can get, mm-hmm. and then go over it all again. Because if all these charts are wrong and need to be amended, is that true? Like, does this chart need to be changed in light of the two numbers you gave us?
No, those are correct.
All right, well, then I think if that's the case, then I think if you feel comfortable talking about the process and how this all works and the solvency of the fund in light of the information we have before us, then let's just go ahead.
Okay. On the chart you have in front of you, the first one is the initial and EUC application. EUC stands for Emergency Unemployment Compensation. This is a federal extension that adds originally 13 weeks and now 20, an additional 13 on top of that. This shows the brand new applications filed throughout 2007, 2008, 2009, and the little arrow on the bottom represents the August meeting when Tyre Byerly spoke to the committee before. You can see the increases after that.
And excuse me, just for everyone who wasn't there, in the interim we had an informational hearing, and some of us were there. Were you there, Representative, with that day? I know Representative Holvey. Representative, were you there, Representative Cameron? And Representative Edwards, were you there?
No.
So they've had the benefit of hearing this before. This is just a reiteration of all that information, just because this committee deals with unemployment insurance. So I will try my best not to interrupt you anymore. Most of his questions.
On the left-hand side of the chart, you can see a line that's going down. That represents the new claims filed in 2009, and you can see it's significantly higher than previous years. That was kind of a shocking week for us. Luckily, it's going in the right direction. The next chart is the total unemployment payments, and it starts in January 2007. And works up through the end of last year. Again, the arrow at the bottom is in August, and you can see on the right-hand side, we hit this wall of claims that just was very large. The dark line represents the emergency unemployment compensation. The extension and the red line is regular benefits. One of the things Tom Barley wanted me to discuss was the things that the department has done to deal with the record-breaking workload. Beginning in July, we began to hire temporary staff to manage unemployment claims, to deal with the additional emergency unemployment compensation. The agency has hired 105 limited duration temporary staff to assist with taking unemployment claims. We undertook a marketing campaign to let customers know that the quickest way to access our services was through the Internet. Our goal is to have approximately 80% of new claims filed through the Internet. We are receiving approximately 70% right now. The Internet allows our staff to process claims after hours and on weekends, thereby freeing up staff to answer more phone calls during regular hours. We have also opened up some of our...
Representative Cameron, please.
Pardon?
Excuse me for interrupting you. I just want to say my office had a call from a person who was having difficulty with their benefits. And frankly, it was sort of a complicated situation. And I served here before. And I figured if we got good service, we should have an answer within a week or two. And within 6 hours of the phone call into your office, it was fully resolved. And I'm disappointed I don't have the person who worked on it. But I just wanted to say that 105 people, at least in this instance, certainly demonstrated outstanding performance. And I wanted to say that.
Thank you.
And there was, I read the bills this morning, and there's something in there, if you're denied, you're notified, and part of it in plain language. And I talked to Representative Riley, who was successful with his plain language bill, and he talked to me about it. One department that, and he couldn't remember which, forgive me, but they were averaging 27 phone calls a day, and because of the plain language part in the statute, then it's reduced to 2 phone calls a day. Do you know, if you have any idea, the reduction in phone calls you just mentioned, is part of that due to plain language in notification of whether you've been given or denied unemployment insurance? Do you have any statistics on that?
Okay. Chair Schaffer, no, I do.
All right, thank
I
you.
Those.
All right, go ahead, please.
We'll see if we can get those.
That'd be great, thanks.
I wouldn't expect to see a reduction in phone calls because there's a certain number of the public that just can't even get through because they get a busy signal. So by freeing up some of the phone lines, by shifting claimants to the Internet, that frees up, you know, the ability for other claimants to get through.
And Ms. Warner talked about that there during the interim. Mm-hmm. I think she was pretty, she was even more elaborate on her explanation, but that's good news. Thank you.
As I said, we're trying to get more claimants to use the Internet. One of the obstacles there is that a certain percentage of the public do not have Internet access. I've taken many of the calls myself and talking to claimants. A lot of them just don't have computers at home or don't have Internet access. So our business and employment service offices have opened on Saturdays to allow claimants to come in, use the computers that we have there. We created a hotline, which is kind of an overflow, so the claimants can call in, and we have staff then dedicated to calling those claimants back. We reassigned staff from other duties to just handle phone calls wherever possible. I'd like to discuss the extensions that are available to claimants. Regular benefits, as I said, pays on average 26 weeks for a claim. Congress in July passed emergency unemployment compensation that added 13 weeks additional benefits. In November, Congress amended that to take that 13 weeks, expand it to 20 weeks. Then they added a Tier 2 that when a claimant exhausts that 20 weeks, has another 13 weeks on top of that. That program ends in August of this year. There are bills before Congress right now to extend that through the end of the year in terms of applying for that extension and then pay benefits through the end of May of 2010. So if that passes, that would be a benefit to our claimants. Due to Oregon's high unemployment rate, Oregon is triggered onto an extended benefit period. So you take the regular benefits, the emergency unemployment compensation, and now we have Oregon extended benefits on top of that, which adds an additional 13 weeks. We expect to trigger into high EB that would take that 13 weeks and convert it to 20 weeks. And that completes my testimony.
Great. Oregon's fund relative to several states is in, we're in good shape. There's some states that are literally have no more money left. Is that correct?
For the record, Mr. Chair, I'm Rob Edwards. I'm the unemployment insurance tax manager for the Employment Department. And yes, sir, that's correct. I saw a recent snapshot of all of the states, and I believe Oregon was second with over $2 billion, and I think Washington was first with over $4 billion. But yeah, several states have had to borrow from the federal government, which is a provision in federal law that they can do. But it ultimately, in order to pay that money back, they have to raise the employment taxes on the employers in that state to do that.
I'd like to think that's over the wonderful, great leadership and direction over the last three sessions prior to this.
Mr. Chair, we would agree, absolutely.
And then we discussed, and there's some concepts floating around out there about, you know, which quarter you start, you know, which where you start going back to adjust or to estimate someone's benefit. And then another one out there, someone wouldn't have to wait a week, they would just get it. Do you want to just talk about those two, I hope I articulated them accurately or intelligently enough for you.
Yes, Chairman Schaffer. The first concept is called an alternate base year. In Oregon and in most states, when someone comes in to file a claim, their claim is based on total wages earned in the first four of the last five completed quarters. So if you have somebody who entered the workforce, let's say 7-8 months ago, they may not have enough wages because the majority of the wages are in the most recently completed quarter. So in filing their unemployment claim, those wages aren't counted. And typically, they will be non-valid and have to wait an additional quarter. And if they're still unemployed 3 months later, then they can file. Those wages get added, and they qualify for valid claim. So the concept of an alternative base year is that if someone doesn't qualify for a claim in the first four of the last five completed quarters, then we would take a look at the four most recent completed quarters and use the same formula and see if they qualify there.
So do you have a, does the department have a bill to do that? Do you know?
Pardon?
Does the department have a bill to do that?
We have a concept, and my understanding is that...
if you want to come up, help us here. Thank you. Sorry about the furniture moving. Just leave it there, too.
I will.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rebecca Nance, the legislative manager for the Employment Department. We did, Mr. Chair, have concepts on the alternative base year that we submitted to the governor's office. Currently, it's my understanding that the other body is having bills drafted, and there were some things that the governor's office didn't like in light of the very rapidly changing economy. I have not seen the new draft language, but it's my understanding that that will be dropped in the other body and that there are conversations in this body, but I'm not privy to that because I'm not working those.
Well, if the kingmakers can't figure it out, you bring it over here and we'll take care of it for you. What about the waiting? What about the waiting week? Is it relating to that alternative, Representative Witt?
Yes.
Okay, please then go ahead and ask your question.
Thank you. Rebecca, can you tell me what the wisdom is in holding back one quarter, four of the last five quarters in a computerized age? And is this not just a holdover from when we used to calculate this by pen and paper?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Witt, you've characterized that pretty accurately. Back in the day when this was instituted, the unemployment insurance system was instituted in the 1930s, things were done pretty much by quill and ink, if you will. Now, employers, by and large, report very quickly. Everything is computerized and automated to a great extent, and the wages appear, and it doesn't take the amount of time and effort that it once did, and that is the reason that's being considered, and 22 other states currently have that, and other states are considering it as well.
Yeah, I think it's a good idea myself.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Did you want... Okay, Representative Colby.
Thank you. In regards to the alternate base period, can you elaborate the importance of states to do that in regards to accessing federal funds?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holvey, currently before Congress, as part of the economic stimulus package, as I understand it, a piece of it has to do with Unemployment Insurance Modernization Act, and that would require states to have an alternative base period if they were to be able to access additional administrative funding. Currently, states are underfunded, including Oregon, for the unemployment insurance, and we pull it out by hook and by crook to get the business of the people taken care of. So that is the wisdom behind that. That's the extra impetus. It's probably the right thing to do anyway, but that being said, we really do need the finances and the money behind it in order to do it successfully in the state.
Anything more on this alternative base?
About the waiting week.
Representative Schaffer, what I think you're talking about is something that happened during the storms of 8, I believe, and we had a situation with emergency of the disaster unemployment insurance, because some people were paid for a waiting week and some people weren't paid for a waiting week. And I know that Mr. Byerly has been working with the congressional delegation, and I know that Representative Witt was involved in this when we were talking about disaster unemployment. It is on the table in Congress currently that the waiting week for if the governor of the state declares an emergency, that states would be able to waive the waiting week. That has not yet passed, but that would have to be in federal law. We do have, I believe, on the books a state law that would allow us, if it's legal by the federal standards, to do that. So we're already in conformity with that. We're waiting for the feds. I will confirm that with you, but I believe Mr. Byerly worked on that during the 08.
But we need session. A governor declaration of emergency if and when we conform with federal law, correct?
Correct.
All right, thank you. Any questions on that? All right, any further questions of these good people? We started off rocky, and we just came out smooth, I think, there.
Chair Schaffler, I'm sure Mr. Byerly regrets not being able to be here today, but these are very brave colleagues I have.
Thank you very much, and we look forward to hearing from Mr. Slater on this formula.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bolvie.
Now, before they step down, just one thing popped into my mind. I recognize that employers pay into the unemployment insurance fund, as was mentioned before, but those payments technically come out of the gross pay of an employee?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, no, in fact, it's against statute for employers to withhold any of the unemployment insurance money from employees' pay. Now, could you make an argument that maybe they pay someone less because they have to pay this payroll tax? I guess you could, but there's no direct deduction.
Thank you for that clarification.
Thank you for asking. Any further questions of these good people? All right. Thank you very much, folks. And I hope Tom gets feeling better soon, believe me. I think I can speak for all of us there. So I'll close the informational meeting just in case I opened it. And then I'm going to... I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2201. And for the public, and I neglected to say this last hearing of meeting, I'm sorry. There's a sign-up sheet over here, or theoretically there is. We already have them. But if anyone in the public wants to speak to these or any other bills throughout the remainder of the session, they're welcome. And I remind me to say that, especially on more contentious bills than these. Okay. I just going to go with the same nice group of guys for this first one. Go right ahead.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Rob Edwards, unemployment insurance tax manager for the Employment Department. I'm here to tell you about House Bill 2201. This is a department-suggested bill, and it actually makes three changes to how we deal with business entities such as corporations, limited liability companies, and limited liability partnerships. The first part of the changes deal with, currently corporate officers are subject to unemployment insurance. However, under certain circumstances, they can elect out. What we found is the statutory election right now is a little restrictive in that if someone starts a business, is busy operating, getting going, and realizes, oh, I intended to opt out of unemployment insurance tax on my corporate officers, they're usually already into the first quarter of payroll, and the statute doesn't allow them to opt out retroactively. If they do the option at that point, they have to wait until the following quarter to opt out. So what we'd like to do is give them the option to opt out retroactively one quarter. So once they open the business and they say, okay, I really don't think I should be in the system, they can opt out and it'll go back one quarter. So that's the provision there that we're doing to 04.
It just sounds like a silly question, but let's say I start a corporation and I got 10 people working for me and comes down to the end of the year and I say, oh, no, wait, they're all corporate officers and I don't want to pay my bill. That can't happen, right?
Mr. Chair, no, it couldn't. It's the criteria for doing this option is that it has to be a closely held family corporation. They also have to be directors. If it was just a regular employee of the corporation, they can't opt out for that person.
Okay. Any questions? Sir, did you have anything to add? Any questions? I plan to work this bill if you've all...
Oh, we've got... Yeah, Mr. Chair, are we done with the testimony on the bill?
That's it.
Oh, well, actually, I have a couple more pieces.
Oh, it does a lot more than that.
I'm sorry. Forgive me.
I'm ready to go. I'm just getting all ready to go here.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. The second part of the changes, and this is actually to deal with a situation that we've had recently. It says in order to qualify for the exclusion for limited liability company or limited liability partnership members, you have to have a 10% ownership in the business. What we found is as the economy gets worse, employers are getting more creative with trying to find ways to cut their costs, including employment taxes. And we ran across a couple of cases where the business said, whenever we hire, in this case, a truck driver, we're going to make them a member of our LLC, and therefore they'll be exempt from unemployment tax. We don't think that's the right way to go, and so what we said is we think they should have a 10% ownership in the business in order to qualify for the exclusion that was meant for the owners of the business. So that's that one. Okay. The third part is to give us the ability to transfer the debt from defunct corporations, LLCs, and LLPs to the owners and officers personally. This is commonly called officer liability or corporate officer liability. Department of Revenue currently has this for their withholding tax, and we would like to have it for unemployment insurance tax also. The basic concept is if I'm in business and I make a decision to pay a bill other than the taxes, then I'm personally held responsible for that decision.
Representative Cameron.
Question.
And Representative, thank you for pointing that out.
Yeah.
Having just dropped in a couple of annual reports on LLCs to the Secretary of State, that's why I was late. I have a question about this. Why the determination of 10%?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, that's an excellent question. We had to start somewhere. And we picked 10% thinking that most LLCs and LLPs have fewer than 10 members or partners, and therefore that would be a good place to start. We are absolutely not tied to that percentage.
Representative, please.
Yeah, a few questions here. So because you can manipulate LLCs quite easily, it'd be easy to start a LLC that owns just one truck and give that truck driver 10% versus making him a 0.5%. I mean, there's all kinds of ways you can manipulate this. So my question is why do we pick an arbitrary number of 10%? And then I want to go back to the first issue is what is the process for a member of an LLC or a corporate officer to opt out of unemployment insurance?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, again, the 10% it seemed to us to be a substantial amount of ownership without also restricting them. I mean, there are legitimate LLCs and LLPs that do have ownership of smaller amounts, so we just thought 10% looked like a good place to start with trying to find something that would work for the legitimate ones, but at the same time give us a tool against the ones that we're trying to get around the system. I don't know if that answers your question or not.
Well, no, it doesn't, because it's still another measurement, and I guess maybe I'm not, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Please, hold on.
Is there anything in statute about family business and how much percentage somebody has to own of a limited liability company to allow their family employees to work and not pay unemployment insurance, child labor laws, for example, not pay their children minimum wage. Do you know what the standard is in the state there?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, I can't speak to other parts of the law. I can only tell you about Chapter 657, unemployment insurance. And LLC members currently are already excluded. So the family exclusion applies only to corporate officers. So if you're an LLC member right now under current law, you're excluded. And that's why we had the problem with the truck company, because they were making all the truck drivers LLC members and excluding them. If you're a corporate officer in a closely held family corporation, then you can ask for an exclusion for just those members, those corporate officers. And they have to be corporate officers, they have to be directors, and between them they have to own, I believe it's 50% or more of the business.
one more question.
Please.
So LLC members are automatically excluded from unemployment insurance?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, correct.
However, if their name is included on the quarterly report and payments are made based on their earnings, would they be eligible for unemployment?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, no. Not on those portion of the wages. And if that was discovered, we would, in fact, refund the money to the business.
Okay. I think it'd be worthwhile that we have some consistency in the law. And I'm not an expert on corporate law and limited liability companies. But I believe there is a certain percentage on a limited liability company that if you own, in other words, I'm thinking of child labor laws here. If you own 1% of a limited liability company as an owner or a member of that company, I couldn't all of a sudden bring in three of my children, I don't believe, and have them work to avoid child labor laws. But I know as an owner with substantial interest, and I believe that number is 5%. I'm just taking that from some history that I've heard someplace, that now as a 5% owner, I could literally have my children involved in a business and I don't fall under child labor laws in the state of Oregon, going back to agricultural issues. So I think we probably should research that out, and maybe there's some consistency here that we might want to set those bars at the same level. Something to consider.
And if the little buggers don't like it, they should go out in the street and get a real job.
I'm just joking. That's a joke.
It is?
Anyway, in all seriousness, I would like to, if I hear the answer to that question. So is there any other state that has a 10% level, or did somebody from, I think I'm going to ask an indelicate question. Did someone say, well, if we put it at 10%, we can just keep raking in all this unemployment insurance payment? So is there another state doing this, and where are they at in this 10%?
Mr. Chair, I'm not aware of any other states that do this, but it wouldn't surprise me if there were, and we can certainly research that and answer your question.
Mr. Chair, if I may, the other option may be is an opt-out, that I have to sign something as a member of this limited liability company that I'm going to opt out of unemployment insurance. Might be some protection for people who have minority or small shares as well.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, we would certainly be open to that.
Okay. And Representative Holby.
I was wondering if you could explain the fiscal impact to the trust funds on this bill. I see that in 2009, 2011, it's $596,000 and then jumps to $1,576,000 in the next biennium. And I've read the analysis, but I'm still trying to figure out why there would be such a fiscal impact to the trust funds.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, that was due to the startup period. We knew that we couldn't apply this retroactive. This is the corporate officer provision that the revenue impact is for. And we realized that we couldn't start it up and immediately start seeing revenue flowing in from it. There would have to be some time period that went by where delinquent taxes actually came due and we went through the assessment process. So we knew the initial startup period would be lower, and then as we went into a full biennium, we'd realize the full amount.
And do you have the legislative revenue impact statement?
I do, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. And it is positive. Any further, folks, we're not going to work this today. I'm going to, in deference to my committee vice chair here, I want to wait and get his questions answered. Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. Just thinking about the economic situation right now, not just for employees, but employers as well, and many might be facing difficulty paying their bills. Bankruptcy might be an answer at some point. So those who actually go into bankruptcy proceedings, then the owners would still be on the hook for, there would be no protection for them from this particular debt.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, that's correct, unless they also filed a personal bankruptcy and included the debt in that.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm unclear about the opt-out provision, or I guess I'm unclear about the opt-in provision. And does one preclude the other? In other words, if I opt out, at what point am I able to opt back in?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, I believe you have to stay opted out for a full calendar year, if I'm remembering correctly. So, in other words, I can cancel the election and opt back in, but there has to be an elapse of some amount of time.
And Mr. Chairman, so if I am anticipating future economic events, I can play the system.
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, you certainly can make business decisions based on those existing statutes. However, the wages that will count towards any unemployment claim are only the wages that were covered.
Understand.
So if you opt out, those wages will be lost for the claim.
Yeah. Thanks. Thank you.
Welcome.
Any other further questions? We're not going to work this today, as I said. Do you have anything else to add right now?
No, sir.
I ask you to get all the answers as much as you can. Go around and talk to all these nice folks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's so common that what looks on the face of it so easy turns out to be not so easy. So that's my charge to you. And unless there's any further questions to these gentlemen, I'm going to let them off the hook and close public hearing on House Bill 2201 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2202.
Chairman Chopper,
you have to
committee.
You have to
tell me. My name is Mark Hetherington. I'm with the Employment Department, and I'm here to testify on House Bill 2202. House Bill 2202 amends ORS 657-270. That's our statute that deals with unemployment hearings, and the amendment, the purpose of it is to give any party to the hearing the ability to request a reopening of that hearing. The purpose of the legislation is to bring Oregon unemployment law into conformity with the Department of Labor's interpretation of federal law. In 2003, 657-270 was changed to allow administrative law judges to dismiss hearings when the parties failed to appear. Unfortunately, the language led to unintended consequences and resulted in a few parties who weren't the individuals who requested the hearing from being allowed to request the hearing be reopened, even though they had good cause for missing the hearing. Section 303A3 of the Social Security Act requires state laws to provide provisions for the opportunity for a fair hearing, and the U.S. Department of Labor has interpreted that to require that we allow claimants or employers the opportunity to request the hearing be reopened if they were unable to attend due to good cause. Not mentioning the rights of other parties in the current statute, the current law has resulted in the improper dismissal of parties' request to reopen a case, a hearing in a contested case, and that omission has the potential of putting Oregon out of conformity with Section 3303 of federal law, and that could lead to the loss of Oregon's $97 million administrative grant. In addition, Oregon employers could be required to pay an additional $1.4 billion in federal unemployment taxes. And that concludes my testimony.
I have a question. Thank you. Beyond the control of the requesting party, do you have a definition of beyond the control, or who determines? Does the administrative law judge determine what is beyond the control of the requesting party? How does that work?
Chair Schaffler, that would be determined by the administrative law judge.
Questions? Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Chair Schaffler. I'm just curious, would they then be able, these parties that had their request dismissed, would they be able to retroactively go after and have another hearing? Would there be a chance to correct the wrong of the past if this were corrected?
Chair Schaffler, Representative Matthews. This would allow an individual who, let's say, couldn't attend because they had a medical emergency, or let's say we had an ice storm like we did in December that shut down the phone lines in some areas. This would allow them to request reopening of the hearing. The administrative law judge would then reconvene the hearing, be able to take testimonies from all parties, and issue a new decision.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please go ahead.
So I guess my point is, though, if these things have already occurred in the past and they've been dismissed, would they have the opportunity then to resubmit if this were to pass?
Retroactively, if this occurred 6 months ago and they've had their request dismissed and denied, would those same individuals now be able to, with the passing of this, be able to come back again 6 months, a year later, and say, well, I was denied my hearing, I'd like to have a hearing and make that request now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Matthews, in the House Bill 2202 on page 2, and it's line 12, the party, one of the requirements is that they submit the request within 20 days of the issuance of the written decision by the administrative law judge. So there is a time limit involved.
So the answer is no.
The answer to your question would be no.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Any more questions? Thanks, guys. I appreciate it. We have Bill Cluding with Carpenters Industrial Council. Bill, come on.
Thank you, Chair Schaffner. Committee, for the record, Bill Cluding, Carpenters and Joiners Council. Listening to the conversations here today, I see down the road we're going to run into a log jam. I'm glad to see 2202 and 2203 come forward. Let's look at the future. We're passing out a stimulus bill for a lot of public works, state and federal. The vast number of our unemployed people in this state, how many of them qualify for public works? How many can go on a bridge project? How many can go on a highway project? Hopefully the unemployment department is sorting through these people. And when these contractors bid on these jobs, they have to have their qualified workers ready to go. Because you have a starting point and an ending point. How do you tell one person that he's qualified to go on this job and deny a person here that claims he could do it, but once he gets on the job, he realizes he can't, or his boss understands he can't, and he terminates him? Is he going to be right quickly be able to get back on his unemployment benefit? A lot of times it's the personal opinion of the person you talk to when you first file your claim or your reclaim. And sometimes you got to go up through the various steps to get to the right person that finally gets the rule book out to the very last chapter that can make the final ruling. But by that time, weeks have went by. Hopefully the employment department and the state can work together. But again, I suggest that right now we ought to be figuring out who can do the work, who can't. Because when they need the qualified workers, if we can't furnish them, they're going to come from out of state. And then they're going to take their money back to where they come from. These are just my personal thoughts, and I thank you for your time.
My pleasure, Bill. Rob, you want to just talk about that potential scenario briefly?
Yeah, briefly, Mr. Chair. Whether or not someone qualifies for benefits is a very long and complicated part of the law. However, we're under time limits under federal rules to make the determination, and we generally try to meet that timeliness. So that first level, what we call adjudication, that adjudication decision is based on the facts as gathered by the adjudicator from both the employer and the employee. So, for example, if someone was laid off or fired from a job because the employer felt like they weren't competent to do the work, that would become a fact-based interpretation by the adjudicator. You know, were they qualified? Are they eligible for benefits, yes or no? And depending on which way the decision went, both parties also have appeal rights. So that does add time to the process. We're basically walking a tightrope here, trying to make sure that we're not paying benefits to people who shouldn't really be getting benefits, but also trying to pay them to everyone who does deserve them. And since benefits paid out are charged to an employer's account and can increase their tax rate in the following year, we also don't want to pay benefits and charge employers when it's not appropriate. So I hope that helps.
Thank you. It does. The question of competence is probably why they don't allow legislators to file for unemployment insurance benefits. Anyway, any further questions or comments?
Thank you, Rob. I appreciate it. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2202. Members, do you feel comfortable working this bill right now? If there's no... Okay, then I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2202 and look for a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2202 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Holvey moves House Bill 2202 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion, concern, questions? Is Representative...
Do you want me to grab him?
Yeah, if you would, please.
Mr. Chair, as long as we're waiting, may I be heard?
Please.
You know, I've heard that it is a tradition...
We're in work session on this. Do you want this on the record in this work session, Representative?
Potentially.
Okay, well then, very well. Proceed.
Because it does pertain to this bill and who might be a candidate to carry this. And while I would never try and interfere with the chair's prerogative, I'm told it's a tradition that freshmen get to sometimes get questioned aggressively when carrying the first bill on the floor. And it
hazed, Representative?
Indeed, indeed. But it would be a shame if my good friend, Representative Matthews, did not get to experience that. I just throw that out there for your consideration.
You are reading the chair's mind, Representative.
Yeah.
You're doing a fine job.
Thank you. I learned it all from you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Witt, do you have any opposition or concerns about this bill?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Because we are in work session.
Thank you.
All right, then, without any... Is there any opposition to this bill? All right, seeing none, so moved. And as the good vice chair has so aptly pointed out, Representative Matthews, would you like to carry this bill on the floor?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. I'd be honored.
Thank you very much. So be it then. All righty then. We're going to close the works. I've already closed it. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2203.
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, again for the record, Rob Edwards, unemployment insurance tax manager with the Employment Department. This is the third of the department's suggested bills for this session today. This particular one has two pieces to it. The first one is what we refer to as hold harmless. What we're trying to do with this is say if there was a provision elsewhere in state law that somehow inadvertently excluded coverage from unemployment insurance, that we didn't want that to take effect. The original version of this language basically said in order to pass an exclusion from unemployment insurance, you had to put that in the Chapter 657. Based on discussions with our AG and Legislative Council, the language ended up being modified to what you see before you today. I do want to put on the record that we have had a concern raised by a sister state agency, and we will be dealing with that concern. We may end up asking for an amendment. I'm not sure at this point, but we certainly did not intend this to be some sort of, you know, employment department law overrules everything. And I can't, to give you the reasons behind this is last session we actually had a couple of different things. We had an existing law for charter schools that said charter schools are excluded from all state statutes except, and then there was a list of exceptions. Well, unemployment wasn't in that exception. So technically, the way the law was, someone could say charter schools don't have to pay unemployment insurance and their people won't be covered by unemployment because there's a state statute that says they're not covered. That would put us out of federal conformity in a big way. So we were able to get that list of exclusions amended so it included unemployment law. The other one that came up last session was a bill that did not go forward, but it was the same sort of language around small schools. It said small schools are exempt from all state statutes except, and then had a list of exemptions, and unemployment tax was not in that list. So that is really our purpose in this. We just don't want any inadvertent exclusions that could possibly affect our standing with the federal government. Because as you heard from Mark earlier, very dire consequences if we're found out of conformity.
And this is just relating to unemployment insurance, right?
Correct,
nothing
Mr.
else.
Chair.
Okay, that question did come up. And we're waiting for some changes on this, so we're not going to work this today. Any questions on this one?
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, there is another
more to go.
Yes, more to go. One last piece. This is actually a technical correction to 657176. Prior to 2007, someone who was disqualified from an unemployment insurance claim and wanted to requalify had to earn a certain dollar amount. Now, the law 176 didn't used to say where they had to earn the money at. So, for example, a disqualified claimant could say, yeah, I worked for my ex-wife and painted her house, and she paid me, gee, just exactly the amount that I need to requalify. Well, that looked like kind of a loophole to us. So what we did last session is we came forward with a change to 176, which said, no, if you're going to requalify, the earnings have to be in subject employment. However, we made a small slip. We said that as the law exists now, the subject employment is subject to FUTA, federal law, subject to another state's unemployment insurance tax law, or Canada's unemployment insurance tax law. What we didn't include was subject to our own unemployment insurance tax law. So to give you an example, a state government worker who is laid off, disqualified, and wants to requalify by being employed again by a state agency wouldn't meet the requalification under the statute as it stands now. So it's just a little technical tweak that we want to fix. And that does conclude my testimony.
I'd like to meet the wife that would pay her husband to paint their house. Anyway.
And I knew there was more testimony. I'm just seeing if you guys are paying attention.
You want me to bring her in?
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, so get serious here. Any questions on this bill? We are not going to work it today. We will be as soon as we get everything we need. All righty then. Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2203. And we didn't have anyone else signed up to testify to any of these, but the offer is still open. Okay, and then I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 20339, and I'd like to call Al Elkins and Mr. Darrell Fuller. Come on up, guys. Okay, come on up, Darrell. I know we'll have Al go first. I think he's out in the hallway. We'll just wait for just a second. Oh, here he comes.
Just one of the vehicles.
Teresa wants to get him.
Sure, I think he's got some guests to testify.
Yeah. Oh, forgive me. You're exactly right, Darrell. Just sit on down, and we'll have these nice. Al, bring as many as you can get up there. I know you had some guests. Bring them on up, and then we'll get going. Al, if you want to just open up your testimony, and then we'll
For the record, I'm Al Elkins, representing the Car Rental and Truck Leasing Association of Oregon. I have prepared testimony here, Mr. Chair, that I will hand out.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We are here today in support of House Bill 2039, a bill that we asked to have introduced. With me today is Sabrina Rakovich, the general manager from Enterprise Rent-A-Car, and Teresa Chapelain from Dollar Rent-A-Car, who's the vice president of operations and also the president of our organization. I have put together a very simple outline for you in my testimony, explaining the problem and the solution that the bill addresses in relation to the problem. The problem is this, and it's with private parking lots, private parking citations. Under the problem statement, while in our rented vehicles, sometimes our customers park in private parking lots. Sometimes they receive a citation while parked in these lots. When the customers return the rented vehicles, they often do not tell us they have received a citation. And I'm sure that's just a lapse of memory.
I'm sure it is as well.
When they get home, they often forget to pay their citations. Again, another lapse of memory. And then on number 5 here, under the problem statement, the rental car company then receives a notice in the mail of the citation and is asked to pay the fine. What House Bill 2039 does is it establishes a system similar to our dealing with photo radar citations. whereby once the rental car company receives a citation notice from the parking facility, the car rental company has 30 days from the mailing of the citation or notice to A, submit to the parking lot owner a certificate of non-liability stating that the vehicle was in custody and control of a renter or lessee under the terms of a motor vehicle rental agreement or lease, and B, it provides the name and address of the renter or lessee. Number two there, once the owner of the parking facility receives the certificate of non-liability, the owner of the parking facility must dismiss the citation or notice with respect to the car rental or leasing company and may issue the citation or notice in the name of the renter or lessee. We're asking for just a small amendment, Mr. Chair, in relation to Section 2 of the bill, that the words driver's license number be removed so that the sentence reads, provides the name and address of the renter or lessee. We just felt uncomfortable providing driver's license numbers to companies, collection companies. And that concludes my testimony, and the real people that I brought today will be glad to answer any of your questions.
And now, before you go and let your other member come up, do you have a note for that amendment?
No, I do not.
Okay. Well, let's get that going.
Okay.
Thank you. All right. Sir, you want to come up and take Al's seat, and we'll just... Were you going to testify, too?
No.
Oh, then forgive me. Go right ahead. And you have to identify yourself for the record, please.
My name is Sabrina Rakovitz, a general manager for Enterprise Rent-A-Car. Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. We certainly appreciate this opportunity. What we're merely asking for is what is currently already in place from an ordinance standpoint for city and state jurisdictions to, this is merely a complement, if you will, something that was overlooked originally. Do you have any questions?
No. Would you like to testify, too? Okay. Questions, folks?
I
Representative Escobar, do you have a question?
How are we going to, if we're not going to pass any information on to the people that had the citation, how are we going to get this to the proper individual? And I know how we do it in photo radar because you have their picture.
We have, and I have an affidavit that shows you what we would send to the parking companies that we currently send them today as to the name of the renter, the time that they rented the vehicle, and an address where they can be contacted.
Okay.
So it is, from a driver's license perspective, if, as a private company, sharing public information, if that is something that you feel is necessary to aid the private or the private parking companies, that's one thing, but it can kind of get into a customer confidentiality issue that we're concerned
with. Right, that's what my concern is.
Follow up. Please go ahead.
Then when we do that, are you going to inform people when they come in to rent your car that if they get a citation that they will be liable for that in the future?
It is within the contract.
Okay.
Information.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Kammer?
Yeah, I wanted to go back to this issue, and the same issue, I guess, providing that driver's license number. These are after this has been sent out to collections then? It's not in an earlier phase?
What initially happens is the citation occurs with the customer renting our vehicle. They find from the license plate number that we are the registered owner. They send us that information.
Who's the they?
The Pacific Auditors Company is.
Okay,
is
so it is the collection agency. It's
yes.
It's not the local government agency.
Correct.
Okay.
It could be the local government, though, correct?
If
you're parked out here and you get a ticket in your Enterprise rental, you would then send that to the City of Salem. Is that correct?
Normally, the City of Salem, we work specifically with the City of Salem as it is, but
okay.
That's specifically, it's separate. Does that make sense?
No.
Okay.
If I have a rental car, I'm parked out in front of the Capitol, I get a ticket, I hand my rental car back to you, inside this bill, you would then pass that information on to the city, and then they would let you off the hook and
correct.
Go after that individual.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you very much. Representative Cameron, then Representative Holby.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And that question is totally off the bill. How's business in the rental market these days?
It's been better. Obviously,
specifically, can you say in our state or you know in the region how you know, compared to last year?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, from what I'm gathering, from what they're telling me, that two things have happened: the economy, obviously, but also these folks are connected with the car industry, the national car industry, and that is also dragging them down quite a bit. So, it's not the best of times for car rental companies.
How does the connection with the national car companies drag down the rental car business? I'm curious that relationship.
It's a big cycle, and at this point, based on the freezing of funds from a credit perspective, dealerships are obviously impacted, and with that, there is less demand to purchase vehicles, so a vehicle that you could have purchased last year is worth significantly less than it is this year. And as one of the major purchasers of vehicles, we find ourselves in a situation where that, from a fund as well as from money from selling of the vehicles, that has impacted us as well as the ability to purchase new vehicles.
So you're keeping your vehicles longer in inventory? Is that one of your changes that you're having to do rather than turning them over?
You will probably see with all rental car companies, vehicles stay within fleet a little longer. For Enterprise, we have probably moved from an 11-month holding time frame to a 13-month holding time frame on average. That's fairly close across the board.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I hope that all improves. Representative Holby.
Wow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just I have two pieces.
Go right ahead,
just for clarification, this bill's essentially aimed at you being able to submit this information to the owner of private parking. And there's something already in statute that allows you to deal with public entities who have their own parking.
That is correct.
But that's not in this bill. So that I'm just clarifying that,
because
public isn't already in statute. And my second question, Mr. Chair.
Please go ahead.
And my second question is as it has been brought up about supplying the driver's license number and the name and address of the renter and all that to a private entity. Not that I'm concerned that you shouldn't be able to do that. I'm concerned that there's nothing in this bill, but maybe there is someplace else in statute that limits what that private company can do with that information specifically. You know, we're in a world of identity theft that this body spent a lot of time trying to get a handle on. And so I want to make sure that there's not an opening here, or there is some sort of something governing that what they're going to use that information specifically for.
I don't know if I could answer to that specifically, but what I can tell you is we are currently supplying that information to them.
Just a thought.
And I believe DMV records are public record too, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
So you can go and get the whole list. But that's a good question, and it's a valid question. Representative Barton.
Mr. Chair, more a comment to that point.
Please go right ahead.
What they can do with that information is tightly regulated both in state and federal law. Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, Fair Credit Reporting Act.
Thank you for that, Representative Burton.
Got it. I'm glad we got a lawyer on this committee. I'm telling you.
Today.
Yeah, I got Representative Dent on it.
We have to be glad.
We have to smile and be happy.
Okay. Any other questions of these good people? And once again, we're not going to work it today. There's some amendments coming up. So. But thank you.
That's it.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members.
Mr. Fuller, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller representing the Northwest Auto Trades Association. We support the bill, but in learning that it was going to be amended, we spoke with those that requested the drafting of the bill, and I spoke with the chair of the committee earlier this morning about hitchhiking on that amendment just a little bit. If you look at the bill on lines 6 and 7, it limits the the provisions of the bill to just a car rental or leasing company. And there are a lot of businesses, including collision and repair facilities and car dealers, who rent vehicles or provide loaner vehicles to their customers as an ordinary part of their business. And so we're going to be requesting an amendment that will simply expand that definition from just rental car companies and allow that same opt-out or that same ability to notify the private garage company of who had rented or who was using that vehicle to other people that provide vehicles as part of their ordinary course of business. And there is a statute that already sort of has that definition created. It's in 30.135, and so we're going to lift some existing language that already deals with businesses that provide vehicles as part of their business and insert that into this bill, as long as that doesn't cause any problems. And if it does, we're certainly not going to try to impede the progress of the bill because of our amendment. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Mr. Fuller today?
Well, Representative Holden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious if while we're amending this, if I could get an amendment that would allow me to not have any of that to liability for the ticket when I loan my car to Representative Barton.
Man, am I glad we got a carpenter on this committee.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, I'll leave that between you and Mr. Barton.
On that question, though, this is strictly for business reasons, and this doesn't allow for that.
Mr. Chair, you have to have a rental agreement, a signed rental agreement, and has to be in the ordinary course of business. With the amendment that I would be recommending, and as the bill currently states, you'd have to be a rental or leasing agent in order to take advantage of the.
And before you can do that, they have to provide you with license, current, up-to-date license, and insurance. That's correct, too, right?
No, Mr. Chair, I believe that's correct.
To avoid all of this possibility. Good. Any further questions? Representative Edwards.
I have a clarifying question. So currently, if you're an employee of a business and you drive a fleet vehicle and you get a parking ticket and you don't pay it, does that come back to you as an individual, or do they end up going to the business that owns the fleet vehicle?
I believe it's a business to business, and I believe Representative Cameron could probably speak to that.
Yeah, Representative, having a business that parks around the city of Salem quite often, I know where the tickets show up. And what we do is try to track down the employee who was in the vehicle at the time, but I have no way to hold them personally liable for that.
Well, thank you for that clarification.
You want to amend the bill for that, too?
Can we do that? I don't think we want to go there, Representative. Representative Kinnaman, please.
Just under the order of business of deja vu all over again, this was an issue back when I was here, and that's when we corrected the issue for rental cars. And what's interesting, the City of Portland had tens of thousands of dollars of outstanding bills and was harassed and was having great arguments with the rental business, let's put it that way.
Interesting.
You can see where the impasse you get to if you don't resolve this matter.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. Any further questions or comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Darrell. Well, I'm going to close, and the public's welcome to testify. I don't see anybody jumping up or down. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2039. And before I adjourn, I want to thank Representative Cameron for pointing out there was more testimony. And I beg all of you, usually Teresa, she probably would, I'm sure she would have caught me. I need help. Keep an eye on me, too.
I know that, Mr. Chair.
Don't hesitate to help the helpless. And I do want to thank Representative Cameron for pointing that out. Any other comments for the good of the order? With that, we're adjourned.